Today's broadcast was originally recorded on March 7th, 2024.
Good things come to those who wait. No better example. But with receipt of this instrument of accession, let me be the very first to welcome Sweden as a party to the Washington Treaty and the 32nd member of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization.
Well, there you go. I guess Russia has no excuse but to attack them.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
They're everywhere. From Pacifica Radio, Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, Blanketing Planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. We will be joined momentarily by one of the folks who was critical to the challenge against Donald Trump's qualification for the ballot to hold public office under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, the so-called insurrection disqualification clause, which the corrupted U.S. Supreme Court earlier this week, as you know, basically made up all new tests, all new things out of whole cloth in order to prevent applying it to insurrectionist Donald Trump.
Making up stuff is something that this U.S. Supreme Court right-wing supermajority is very good at.
It is, isn't it? How's that cold doing, Des?
It's still here.
It is. You're welcome. Anyway, this is, the high court did not challenge the finding that Trump engaged in insurrection when he incited the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, to try and steal the election that he had lost to Joe Biden. Nonetheless, they said, well, yeah, that Constitution of ours, you better not use it unless we say it's okay to. So what now? What next after that important, yes, conservative campaign to actually follow the Constitution as written, after that has been stopped dead in its tracks by the activist Republican majority Supreme Court? What is next? Well, Ron Fine of Free Speech for People will be here to discuss it and offer his group's reaction to the Supreme Court ruling. First, some quick news of note today. As you heard at the top of the show there, that was U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken at a ceremony in Washington on Thursday, formally welcoming Sweden as the newest member of the NATO alliance. So I guess if we were to believe the Kremlin propaganda that's been forwarded by so many on the right and frankly too many on the left, well, Sweden should now prepare itself to be attacked by Russia because, well, growth of NATO as a defensive alliance near Russia's border is the only reason that Russia had no choice but to invade its sovereign neighbor of Ukraine, even though for those having trouble keeping up, Ukraine is not actually a part of the alliance, and its application to join NATO has actually been turned down by NATO. because they do not yet meet the requirements to join NATO, even if the door remains open for them in the future. But Sweden formally joined NATO as the 32nd member of the Transatlantic Military Alliance on Thursday, ending decades of post-World War II neutrality and centuries of broader non-alignment with major powers as security concerns in Europe have spiked following Russia's 2022 invasion of Ukraine. Yes, the very thing Russia supporters claim that Russia went to war to prevent, the expansion of NATO. Well, that has now happened because of their invasion of Ukraine, which is not in NATO. By the way, for additional note, just to folks who have been disinformed with, yes, literally Kremlin propaganda, Vladimir Putin has actually said on a number of times that he has no problems with new countries joining NATO, even though his apologists keep citing that as the reason why Russia had no choice but to attack Ukraine. So, yeah, look it up, friends. Anyway, President Joe Biden congratulated Sweden on the on its admission and said it was a sign that Russian President Vladimir Putin's intervention in Ukraine had united rather than divided the alliance.
I don't think that that's what Putin was going for.
Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson, well, he was going for the to denazify Ukraine of its Jewish president and Muslim defense minister. Anyway, Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson at the State Department on a ceremony on Thursday said, quote, "Today is truly a historic day. We are humbled but proud. We will live up to high expectations from all NATO allies. United we stand. Unity and solidarity will be Sweden's guiding light." Later Thursday, Kristersson was to visit the White House and then be a guest of honor at President Biden's State of the Union address. The Swedish flag will be raised outside of NATO's headquarters in Brussels on Monday. NATO Secretary Jens Stoltenberg underscored that the Nordic country, quote, "now enjoys the protection granted under Article 5, the ultimate guarantee of allies' freedom and security. Article 5 of NATO's treaty obliges all members to come to the aid of any ally whose territory or security is under threat. It has only been activated, however, once in all of its many years by the U.S. after the September 11, 2001 attacks, and it is the collective security guarantee that Sweden has sought since Russia invaded Ukraine." Stoltenberg added that the move demonstrates that NATO's door remains open and that every nation has the right to choose its own path. Sweden, along with Finland, which joined NATO last year, both abandoned longstanding military neutrality that was a hallmark of the Nordic states' Cold War foreign policy after Russia invaded Ukraine in early 22. On Thursday, it was reported that President Joe Biden will announce a plan in his State of the Union address for the U.S. military to help establish a temporary port on the Gaza coast to increase the flow of humanitarian aid for the beleaguered territory during the Israel-Hamas war. An administration official said the operation will not require that American troops be on the ground to build the pier that is intended to allow more shipments of food, medicine, and other essential items into the besieged territory where Israel's far-right government has prevented the flow of critically needed food and other humanitarian aid in the now 5-month siege of Gaza. 5 months of fighting between Israel and Hamas have left much of the Hamas-run territory in ruins and led to a worsening humanitarian catastrophe. Aid groups have said it has become nearly impossible to deliver supplies within most of Gaza because of the difficulty of coordinating with the Israeli military, the ongoing hostilities, and the breakdown of public order. The U.S. military also recently began airdropping aid into Gaza. But obviously, as trucks with food and other aid have been greatly limited from coming into Gaza and airdrops are sort of limited, being able to pull up, you know, huge tankers to the coast to offload much-needed aid to a starving populace is a seemingly fantastic idea that needs to happen sooner rather than later at this point. Let's hope this moves ahead quickly. And as we noted yesterday regarding Vice President Harris's remarks over the weekend calling for a, quote, immediate ceasefire, hopefully all of this is a signal that the Biden administration is hearing the concerns from voters loud and clear regarding their current support for Israel, despite the atrocities that they continue to carry out against civilians in Gaza. And I believe we have time for one more here before we get to our guest. And yes, our latest Green News report with a cold-ridden Desi Doyen with some of her thoughts on the stakes in this year's election now that the candidates for president are theoretically set following the recent Super Tuesday elections and Nikki Haley dropping out of the GOP race, etc. I say theoretically set because, well, we have this today from AP, the third party presidential movement calling itself No Labels, is planning to move forward, fielding a presidential candidate in the November election, even as high-profile contenders for the ticket have decided not to run. That, according to two people familiar with the matter on Wednesday, after months of leaving open whether the group would offer a ticket, No Labels delegates are expected to vote Friday in favor of launching a presidential campaign for this fall's election.
They're going to do it anyway.
According to these sources, for AP sources in any event, No Labels will not name its presidential and vice presidential picks on Friday when roughly 800 delegates meet virtually in a private meeting. Now, with 800 people, I do not expect that private meeting, probably a video conference, to remain private for long, frankly. But
you know, it's pretty shocking that they want to decide this in secret.
Well, they are instead expected on Friday to debut a formal selection process for potential candidates who would be selected in the coming weeks. I guess in secret, we'll see. Polls suggest many Americans do not have favorable views of either Joe Biden or Donald Trump, a dynamic that No Labels sees as opening to offer a bipartisan ticket. Now, that said, where is the evidence that Americans have a favorable view of that? Biden supporters worry No Labels will pull votes away from the president in battleground states. They're critical of how the group will not disclose its donors or much of its decision making. The group has been weighing what it would present as a so-called unity ticket to appeal to voters. No Labels strategists have said they'll give their ballot line to a bipartisan ticket with a presidential nominee from one major party and a vice presidential nominee from the other if they see a viable path to victory. Group officials have said they are communicating with several potential candidates. They've been saying that. Haven't they been saying that for months and months? They haven't disclosed any names. But of course, that's what America is clamoring for, a secret process for finding a unity ticket. Republican Nikki Haley said she is not interested in running as a No Labels candidate. Conservative Democratic West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin has said he will not seek the presidency as he is not seeking re-election this year. Maryland's Republican former governor Larry Hogan, who had been involved with the group, he's now instead seeking a U.S. Senate seat this year. So it's unclear who they're even thinking of. But as AP notes, No Labels has stockpiled cash from people that it has declined to name, including former Republican donors who have become disenchanted with the party's direction in the Trump era. So I guess it may depend on your definition of unity, I suspect, even as the group has worked to secure ballot access in every state. Well, that should keep things lively for the next few months. hey, maybe they will draft former corporatist Democrat turned corporatist independent Senator Kyrsten Sinema. I hear she's leaving the Senate and I hear she's not going to run. She'll have some free time on her hands this year. She could be, I don't know, the presidential nominee, and then they could get that QAnon guy with the horns who invaded Congress on January 6th because apparently insurrectionists, according to the corrupted activist Republicans on the U.S. Supreme Court, they're completely clear now to run for the highest office in the land, so they could get that guy on the ticket. It's all good. Insurrectionists are us, apparently, despite the U.S. Constitution clearly telling us otherwise, but don't mind that. The rise and sham cancellation of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the broadcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. But if you try sometimes, well, you might find you get what you need.
We'll see. Working on it. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. The 14th Amendment was and is a hugely important amendment to our U.S. Constitution for a host of reasons. Much of it we hear about every day, such as Section 1, which reads that all persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States, and that states may not deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, and that no person shall be denied equal protection of the laws, etc. All constitutional guarantees that were part of a series of amendments prohibiting slavery after the Civil War to ensure the legal rights of all people in America. Now, I am anything but a constitutional scholar, much less an attorney. But Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is pretty easy to understand. It's only two sentences long. It's easy to read. The first sentence, though a bit of a run-on, is, "No person shall be a senator or representative in Congress or elector of president and vice president or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or under any state, who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States or as a member of any state legislature or as an executive or judicial officer of any state to support the Constitution of the United States, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof." That's the first sentence. The second and final sentence of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, quote, "But Congress may, by a vote of 2/3 of each house, remove such disability." In other words, if Congress wants to, it may waive the prohibition against serving in office by insurrectionists, even if that requires a very high bar, a supermajority vote by each chamber of Congress. Clearly, the framers of the 14th Amendment wanted to make sure that insurrectionists could not hold office at either the state or federal level unless a whole bunch of folks in Congress made damn sure they wanted to waive that disqualification for any particular person who had insurrected against the United States government. As noted, I'm not a constitutional scholar, but the plain text of that amendment is easy to both read and understand. Now, there is one other qualifier to this section of the 14th Amendment in the single sentence Section 5, which reads in full, quote, "The Congress shall have power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this article." Shall have power, if they wish to exercise it, to adopt legislation to help enforce the provisions of this amendment. Though without such legislation, nobody would be deprived of their constitutional rights, for example, to due process or equal protection under the laws, etc. Slavery is not allowable, no matter what laws Congress passes to ensure that it is prohibited, because it says so in the Constitution. But given that until January 6th of 2021, we haven't had many insurrections following the Civil War, even few constitutional scholars took notice of that Section 3 ban on insurrectionists holding public office in the 150 or so years since its adoption into our Constitution. But in the summer of 2020, Gerald Maglioka, a law professor at Indiana University, decided he would research the history of those two long-neglected sentences in the Constitution's post-Civil War amendment that prohibit those who, quote, engaged in insurrection or rebellion from holding public office. Maglioka posted a copy of his research, which he believed was the first law journal article ever written about Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, online in mid-December of 2020. He then revised and reposted it on December 29, and then 8 days later, President Donald Trump's supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol in an effort to prevent the certification of his loss to Joe Biden, an effort, in fact, to try and steal the election that Joe Biden had won. Maglioka watched as Republicans like Senators Mitch McConnell and Mitt Romney described the attack as a, quote, insurrection. That night, Maglioka composed a quick post on a legal blog writing, quote, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment might apply to President Trump. And months later, as we noted earlier this week on the show, our friends at the nonprofit election watchdog FreeSpeechForPeople.org would be the first to mention Section 3 in a public document. FSFP, as we reported on this show not long thereafter, sent letters to top election officials in all 50 states that summer, warning them not to place Donald Trump on the ballot if he decides to run again in 2024 because he had violated the provision. They are as responsible as anyone in this nation for helping you to understand that free speech for people is. To understand that, yes, Section 3 exists, and yes, it bars insurrectionists who previously held office from doing so again after engaging in insurrection or rebellion. And yes, it applies to Donald J. Trump. Or at least, that's what the framers thought when they wrote it. Now, we followed Free Speech for People's efforts to enforce the measure against other candidates who had participated in the insurrection over the next year or so, even as the bulk of the corporate media dismissed the insurrection disqualification clause of the U.S. Constitution as something that was obscure or quaint, simply because it hadn't been invoked so frequently after the Civil War had sort of faded into history. Free Speech for People's founder, longtime constitutional law expert John Bonifaz, a friend of this show and a guest here over the years, told AP that, quote, people were just treating it as something that was not serious. But we stayed on it. Because in November of 2022, Donald J. Trump would indeed declare his candidacy for another run at office after losing in 2020 and failing to steal the election through, among other things, by inciting that deadly insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. After a bipartisan majority in the U.S. House found, in fact, that Trump had incited the insurrection and impeached him for having done so, a bipartisan 57-43 majority of the U.S. Senate found him guilty in what would become Trump's second impeachment as president. A few years later, at the end of last year, following 5 days of trial testimony and evidence, the Colorado Supreme Court issued a comprehensive, more than 200-page ruling which sided with four Republicans and two unaffiliated voter plaintiffs who had filed suit to argue that Donald Trump had, in fact, engaged in insurrection and was therefore barred from public office and disqualified from the state's primary election under Section 3. The court found that both the text of the amendment and the intent of its framers was crystal clear. Having engaged in insurrection against the United States, Donald Trump was barred from public office and thus the Colorado ballot. People were finally taking the matter quite seriously. Of course, Trump quickly appealed that ruling to his friends on the U.S. Supreme Court, three of whom had he had appointed himself to their lifetime seats on the highest court in the land. And the court responded quickly to that appeal. Days later, they scheduled an oral argument. They held that argument in early February and issued their ruling 1 month later, this past Monday, 1 day before Colorado's primary election would conclude on Super Tuesday. Given the questions at oral argument last month, the ultimate ruling by the court this Monday was not completely unexpected, though, as we discussed on the show earlier this week with former Deputy Assistant Attorney General Lisa Graves and longtime legal journalist Chris Geidner, it was still remarkable in its hypocrisy, as it completely ignored the very clear textualism and originalist intent that the corrupted 6-3 right-wing majority of the court had long pretended to be the very basis for its so-called conservative constitutional judicial philosophy. As actual conservative judge, the well-respected and now former Reagan-appointed appeals court judge Michael Luttig said in response to the court's ruling this week, it's, quote, stunning in its overreach. It's a textbook example, he said, of the kind of activist judicial opinion from the 1960s that begat the conservative legal and judicial movement in the 1970s and 80s. It's also, according to Free Speech for People's constitutional law experts John Bonifaz and Ron Fine and Ben Clements yesterday in an op-ed at jurist.org, quote, an error of historic proportions and a sham. The U.S. Supreme Court determined to avoid the overwhelming evidence that Trump engaged in insurrection, invented an exception to Section 3, applicable only to federal candidates such as Trump, in order to rule in his favor, they wrote. That they called an error of historic proportions and a sham. Joining us now to discuss the court's error, which I believe is putting it nicely, and its sham to protect Donald Trump to allow him to stay on this year's ballot, is Ron Fine, legal director at Free Speech for People, a nonpartisan, nonprofit government accountability group. Mr. Fine, welcome back to the broadcast. And before anything else, let me thank you for what you and FSFP have done to actually try to enforce the Constitution, yes, conservatively, the way it is actually written, no matter what the no matter the uphill fight that you guys had to wage to do so over the past 3 years or so.
Thank you, Brad, for having me, and thank you for helping to get the word out about these important issues.
So why, in your opinion and that of FSFP's, was Monday's ruling by the High Court an, a, quote, error and a, quote, sham?
It had nothing to do with the text of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, nor of the history or original public understanding of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Instead, the justices, and it's not just the six conservative justices, mm-hmm. but also three so-called liberals, started from the endpoint of the result that they wanted to reach and then worked backwards to find a rationale. And that's what's most disappointing. If they had wanted to say that Trump didn't engage in insurrection, mm-hmm. I would have actually had a little bit more respect. It would have been very brazen and obviously ridiculous, but at least they would have been straightforwardly saying something that would have meant that he wasn't disqualified if they wanted to defy all evidence and say that he didn't engage in insurrection. But instead, they fabricated an exception that can be found nowhere in the Constitution that basically lets Trump and others off without ever confronting the merits of what he did.
And I sort of want to break down this ruling a little bit, because it was sort of in two parts in general. The court found, as you noted, 9-0 that Colorado did not have the right to remove Trump from the ballot, though they stridently disagreed 5-4 with the court's new requirements, seemingly, as you know, made up out of whole cloth. It's found nowhere in the Constitution that Section 3 may only apply to state and local officials, but not to federal officials, unless Congress adopts a law to enforce Section 3. Now, I have problems with both of the findings. So let me start with that first one. The court claimed during our oral argument and then in the in that 9-0 portion of their opinion, with even the liberals somehow agreeing with this for some reason, that one state should not be allowed to determine the results of the election for the entire nation. And I never understood that. How does Colorado removing Trump from the ballot determine the results of the election for the rest of the nation? Am I missing something, Ron Fine?
You're not. And part of this is because we have state by state elections, mm-hmm. both at the primary stage, as we're seeing right now, and in the general election. We have, for better or worse, an electoral college system. And I say for worse because mm-hmm. in many ways it is worse, but that is the system that we have. That's the system under which Donald Trump became president in 2016. And it is not at all uncommon, both in the primaries and in the general election, for some candidates to be on some states' ballots and not others. In fact, we're going to see that in this election. We're going to see RFK Jr. will be on some states' ballots, but not all of them. Cornel West will probably be in the same situation. And the Constitution says that states have the power to determine how they appoint electors. But what's especially disingenuous about that is that if what the court was really concerned about was a patchwork of different decisions, mm-hmm. they would have avoided that by actually saying what the correct answer was. This sort of feigned helplessness by the Supreme Court is trying to mask the fact that they are the Supreme Court. They could have just said Trump engaged in insurrection. That's the one answer for the entire nation. Or if they really wanted to, they could have said Trump did not engage in insurrection. But the idea that they're going to be faced with, you know, 50 or 51, if you count D.C., different decisions, and there's absolutely nothing that the U.S. Supreme Court can do about it. That's what's so disingenuous.
Well, and I would also add, a couple of points. It should be noted here, because it has not received a lot of attention, though the court did not, I guess, out loud, say that he engaged in insurrection. They also did not say that he didn't. The Colorado Supreme Court spent dozens and dozens of pages detailing their finding that, yes, Trump engaged in insurrection. But nobody in the U.S. Supreme Court ruling actually disagreed or contested that finding, did they?
I think that's a really important point. So three states so far have found that Trump engaged in insurrection and is disqualified under Section 3, Colorado, Maine, and Illinois. And no state that actually reached the merits found the opposite. No state ever said that he didn't engage in insurrection. And the U.S. Supreme Court in this decision didn't say, sorry for the double negative, but they didn't mm-hmm. say that he didn't engage in insurrection. In other words, they refused to exonerate him. And that's important.
I think there was actually a couple of instances when the liberals on the court actually referred to insurrectionist Trump or something like that. Going back to that first point, though, and the idea that Robert F. Kennedy may not be on all of the state's ballot, Cornel West and so forth. I mean, doesn't that using the Supreme Court's own idea here that if you take Donald Trump off the ballot in Colorado, somehow that means that Colorado is deciding the election for everyone. Doesn't that offer an argument to Bobby Kennedy to walk in and say, well, you can't disqualify me from any ballot. I must be on all 50 states' ballots. Otherwise, it's somehow unconstitutional using their own logic?
It makes no sense. And it's something that was made for this case only. It was a hastily written decision. And from the oral argument, it was pretty obvious that a majority of the Supreme Court was going to find a way to rule that Trump had to stay on the ballots. That's the outcome they wanted. They thought that was better for America. They were going to scramble to find a rationale for it. But I want to point out that as you read at the top of the segment, Section 3 actually does have a provision for who gets to decide whether it's better for the country for an insurrectionist to be allowed to return to public office. It says Congress can do that by a 2/3 vote of both houses. Mm-hmm. So if Congress wants to say that, you know what, whatever Trump did, we want to forgive it. We think it's better for the country to reconcile and move forward, remove his disqualification. They can do that. 2/3 vote of both houses. And then we would have had no case. and really no constitutional objection to raise. But it doesn't say the Supreme Court gets to decide that as a matter of policy and say that they think it would be better for the country. But that's exactly what they did. And in doing so, they're not interpreting the law.
And I would say this is not the first time they have done this. The issue, they used this issue before of sort of uniformity. It came up in Bush v. Gore back in 2000. It was the last time that the court had an outcome that they wanted in a presidential election related case. And they went about making up these constitutional tests from whole cloth to justify it. At that time, they said Florida had to stop counting ballots because there were different standards that were being used in different counties. It all had to be uniform. All counties had to use the same type of counting. Even, you know, within the same county, the problem is some votes are cast on, you know, absentee paper ballots counted by an optical scanner. Others might be cast on a touchscreen. This idea of uniformity, first cited, at least to my knowledge, in Bush v. Gore and now echoed here, pardon me, Ron, but I'm not a legal scholar, seems to be 100% BS. Again,
I would say that's correct. And the Supreme Court is a big part of that. Remember, some states differ wildly in who they even allow to vote.
Right.
Some states say that if you've been, you know, convicted of a crime and you serve time in prison, even after you're out of prison, you still can't vote. Other states allow people to vote while they're incarcerated. Some states have very strict requirements about you have to, you know, prove your identity in all these different ways. Other states have different requirements. And so the idea that we would have one uniform system doesn't match the reality of America. And in previous cases, the Supreme Court has actually struck down a provision of the Federal Voting Rights Act that Congress was using to try to maintain some degree of uniformity in voting rights. So this is something that they pull when they want to, but has no real basis in reality.
It's just maddening. Now, the second part of the ruling, which even Trump-appointed Justice Amy Coney Barrett wasn't willing to buy, was that not only could Colorado not remove Trump from the ballot, but nobody could remove any federal official from the ballot until and unless Congress makes a law describing how it should be done. The states are free to do so, apparently. The local officials can be removed, but not federal candidates. Again, maybe I'm missing it, but I see absolutely no basis for that in the text of the Constitution. They just made that up.
That's right. I mean, the Constitution says that Congress does have power to enforce by legislation, Section 3 and the other parts of the 14th Amendment, but that's never been interpreted to mean exclusive requirements for Congress to pass legislation. And the first part of the 14th Amendment, which says that everyone is entitled to equal protection from the laws and due process of the law, provides a perfect example because those are enforced in state courts every day with no special federal legislation needed. It so happens that Congress has passed legislation to make them even stronger, but it has never been understood that you only have constitutional rights if Congress passes legislation that says that you do.
So moving forward, Ron, is Trump free now to sort of insurrect his way into the White House this time if he loses again in November? Has SCOTUS just sort of offered him a roadmap to do so? And even the Supreme Court, it seems to me, based on their own ruling, would be unable to rule if he does it again, you know, that he's barred for insurrection under the 14th Amendment. I mean, if Congress hasn't adopted a law to enforce it by then, and it does not look as if they will, isn't this a roadmap to insurrection, really?
As far as federal office goes, they have basically whittled Section 3 down to just a bare sliver that will only be possible if Congress, which is, of course, closely divided and could never do this, and the Supreme Court knows this, passes specific legislation to enforce Section 3. So, yeah, they're giving Trump a wide open lane. And when you combine this with the way that they're slow walking the appeals on his presidential immunity claim, it seems that they're giving him a lot of leeway and impunity.
the damage is done, nonetheless, it seems. And the cause, I guess, for now anyway, Ron Fine, is lost. Looking forward, is there any way to change this? Is there any, a chance that Congress would at some point adopt a law to execute Section 3? And what, if anything, can or should be done in response to this, this frankly, Dred Scott-level, you know, sort of made-up activist misinterpretation of the Constitution?
I think there are a few different actions. So one is of legislation could be passed. I know that Representative Jamie Raskin has reintroduced a bill that he'd earlier introduced, but it didn't go anywhere. And while I think it's an excellent bill, I don't think anyone is terribly enthusiastic about its likelihood of passage within the next few months, certainly. More broadly, court itself is in need of reform. Mm-hmm. And one thing that we haven't talked about is that 5-4 split on the exact extent of the ruling included Clarence Thomas, who never should have participated in the case because his wife was involved in January 6th. He should have recused. And that just illustrates how the Supreme Court has become unreliable beyond measure in terms of protecting the Constitution and our constitutional democracy. But third, as we look forward to the 2024 general election, it's more important than ever to protect voting rights, to make sure that voters have a chance to vote safely, fairly, and freely without voter intimidation by private organizations and shadowy groups threatening voters, and without state officials unduly restricting their voting rights.
In a chilling conclusion to your piece at jurist.org yesterday, we will link to it, of course, from brandblog.com when we post today's show. But you and John Bonifaz and Ben Clement note in your piece, quote, if Trump wins, prepare for a third term. Sure, the 22nd Amendment says that, quote, no person shall be elected to the office of the president more than twice, unquote. But Trump has already claimed that he's entitled to a third term because, quote, they spied on my campaign. They didn't spy on his campaign, but nonetheless, that's the claim he's making. If he does make that argument, Ron, is there any reason to believe that this, his corrupted high court would not also, again, find some other way to agree with him, and we would all be stuck living with that ruling?
I think we would face the same type of situation. If he runs for a third term, we'll file challenges in states, and he'll argue that there's some exception to the 22nd Amendment that nobody ever saw. It's not written in the text. It's not really he didn't really serve two terms because there was the Russia hoax or whatever he's going to argue. And then the U.S. Supreme Court is going to say states can't enforce the 22nd Amendment, so he has to appear on all the ballots. And then that's exactly the same situation we would be in if there was no 22nd Amendment.
Ron, I got to get out of here, but you mentioned Clarence Thomas, and I've asked a few of my other guests about this, but you mentioned Clarence Thomas, that he should have recused. That part seems obvious since his wife participated in that insurrection. But what about the notion that Amy Coney Barrett and Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch, they were all appointed by this guy whose very future is being determined by them? I mean, if it was the boss at a partner at a law firm or something that they worked at, they would recuse themselves, I would think, if his case came before them. Why not the guy who appointed them to a lifetime job? Shouldn't all three of them, in addition to Clarence Thomas, have recused themselves?
Well, what's interesting about both Gorsuch and Barrett is that both of their appointments were made under suspect circumstances, I guess. Gorsuch, of course, filled the seat of Scalia, which the Senate had forced to be held open for almost a year because the Republicans didn't want to allow President Obama to make an appointment. And that the theory was that they should wait until the election. Amy Coney Barrett was appointed under the exact opposite scenario, which was that, Ruth Bader Ginsburg had just passed, and right before the election, basically, she was rapidly nominated and confirmed. So both of them do bear sort of an asterisk next to their names. I don't want to go so far as to say that a Supreme Court justice can't rule on a matter concerning the president who appointed them, because they do that all the time. But certainly it does cast a pall on their participation.
Well, I will be I'm happy to say it. They should recuse in that case. We're not talking about, you know, deciding on one of their policies or something like that. We're talking about, you know, their very future. We're talking about themselves. I just think it's absurd that they're allowed to sit on a case like that. You know, but of course, they're allowed to do anything they want. They're the Supreme Court. There are no rules. They make up their own rules. And there ain't nothing you or I or anyone else can do about it unless we can get that reform to the court that you're talking about. And I know the Free Speech for People will be pushing, at least I hope, as we move forward. Ron Fine, thank you again to you and to Boniface and Clement and everyone at FSFP who has joined us over the past several years to focus on this matter. I mean, if nothing else, I'd like to think we can walk away knowing that at least the U.S. Supreme Court kind of agrees with Colorado and the, you know, both chambers of the U.S. Congress that Donald Trump is, in fact, an insurrectionist. What we now do with that knowledge, well, that remains to be seen. But thank you again, Ron Fine, for at least helping the nation to see that a bit more clearly. Ron Fine is the legal director of freespeechforpeople.org. You can find them on the site still known as Twitter at FSFP. Ron, always great speaking with you, and I'm sure we're going to come up with other reasons to give you a shout in the near future. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you. I'll look forward to it.
You bet. Okay, quick break, and we are back with the sickly Desi Doyen and our latest Green News report right here on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is serving you. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you.
You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast.
Well, news moves quickly around these parts these days. We've already got an update
on
today's GNR, so we will get to that after our latest Green News Report.
Remember the 5th of November.
2024 presidential election nominees are set, and the climate stakes could not be higher.
The extent of the damage here is profound.
Lawsuit blames downed utility pole for record Texas wildfires. Plus,
this is not a pattern that we've ever seen before.
Atlantic Ocean keeps breaking heat records.
All of those stories and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Kirsten Sinema taught everyone a very important lesson, that you can't assume someone's beliefs based on how they dress. She came on the scene like, hey, everyone, look at my pink tutu. You know I'm liberal. And then she walks into the Senate like, drill those orphans for oil.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I know you've got some thoughts on the fallout from Super Tuesday, but before we get there, we got to go back down to Texas.
Yes, we do. Fire crews in the Texas Panhandle are gaining ground against the largest fire in state history, but officials say it will take years to recover from its catastrophic impact. CNN reports that the Texas cattle industry has been decimated, and much of the loss of crops, homes, buildings, and livestock are not covered by insurance. A new lawsuit filed this week by a Texas resident who lost her home alleges that a splintered utility power pole owned by Xcel Energy sparked the Smokehouse Creek fire. If confirmed by investigators, it would be another damning incident of utility companies failing to maintain their equipment, similar to deadly fires in California.
And also failing to bury those lines for safety, right?
Yep. In politics, Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley withdrew from the race in the wake of Super Tuesday.
Sad.
Meaning insurrectionist Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee, facing President Joe Biden in the November election. Their differences on everything, but particularly climate, could not be more stark. Donald Trump claims that man-made global warming is a hoax and vows to expand extraction of fossil fuels that cause dangerous man-made climate change, repeal clean air and water laws, and more. President Joe Biden vows to expand his landmark climate policies and legislation that have returned manufacturing to the U.S., cut emissions, made the U.S. a leader in the global clean energy sector, and generated an historic jobs boom.
Wow, sounds bad.
A new analysis published this week calculates that a second Trump presidency would explode U.S. carbon dioxide emissions compared with a second Biden term. Analyzing Trump's stated plans and his pledges to dismantle Biden's climate policies, nonprofit climate data firm Carbon Brief found that a Trump presidency would unleash additional CO2 emissions through 2030, equivalent to the combined annual CO2 output of Europe and Japan, and doom any chance of limiting global warming to the 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature goal under the Paris Agreement.
What the hell are we doing?
That would, quote, negate twice over all of the savings from deploying wind, solar, and other clean technologies over the last 5 years globally. Meanwhile, the consequences of man-made climate change are accelerating. A new study in the journal Nature warns that dozens of cities along the U.S. coastline are sinking at alarming rates, leaving them far more exposed to devastating flooding from rising seas much sooner than previously predicted. It's the first study to combine rising sea levels with measurements of areas that are sinking to show coastal locations most at risk of inundation. The research say large areas, particularly along the eastern seaboard and the Gulf of Mexico, are sinking faster every year due to extraction of groundwater and oil and gas, among other factors. At risk are billions of dollars in critical infrastructure like cities, military installations, and the nation's ports. Finally, right now in the North Atlantic Ocean, sea surface temperatures have been at record warm levels for an entire year now. Literally, each calendar day setting a record high compared to prior years for 365 consecutive days and counting. Meteorologist Brian Norcross explained in an interview with Fox Weather that forecasters are very concerned that record ocean heat will generate very intense hurricanes later this year.
This is not a pattern that we've ever seen before, but the main point of will storms likely form sooner in the season out east of the Caribbean islands? I think that's a probable yes. It's just impossible, really, to tell at this point. But the warm water is certainly not something we want to see.
That was on Fox Weather?
Yes.
Fox News' weather?
Yes.
Well, isn't that interesting? For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.brandblog.com. Someone's going to get fired over there. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
So long and thanks for all the fish. So sad that it should come to this. We tried to warn you all, but oh dear.
Well, we did try.
We have.
We did try to warn them.
Yep.
Anyway, thank you very much, Desi Doyen. So a quick update on that story you mentioned, the woman who is suing because of a power pole.
A resident in Texas,
yeah,
who is a victim of the fire, whose home was destroyed, has filed a lawsuit against Xcel Energy and its subsidiaries.
Mm-hmm.
That's the utility that serves her area, for failure to maintain its power poles,
mm-hmm,
with saying that, you know, they have evidence that the power pole snapped and was not turned off, and so it sparked the fire because it was a live wire.
And so we reported that this morning. Then not long thereafter, this from AP and others, power lines ignited. Massive wildfires across the Texas panhandle, including the largest blaze in state history, that the utility provider Xcel Energy said its equipment appeared to have sparked. The Texas A&M Forest Service said its investigators have concluded that power lines ignited both the historic Smokehouse Creek fire that has burned nearly 1,700 square miles and spilled into neighboring Oklahoma, and that nearby Windy Deuce fire, which has burned about 225 square miles. The statement did not elaborate on what led to the power lines igniting the blazes, but the utility provider stated, quote, based on current available information, Xcel Energy acknowledges that its facilities appear to have been involved in an ignition of the Smokehouse Creek fire. That the wildfires that ignited last week in the windswept rural area amid 80-degree heat in February.
Yes, and wind gusts topping 50 miles an hour.
Prompted evacuations in a handful of small communities, destroyed as many as 500 structures, killed at least two people, and thousands of heads of cattle. So this would seem to support the story that you reported on regarding the lawsuit by the woman who sued over that downed power line near her house, sparking the Smoke Creek fire when that apparently that the Xcel Energy failed to, she says, failed to properly inspect, maintain, and replace when it splintered and snapped off at its base.
Right. Now, we should be clear that Xcel Energy, of course, after acknowledging that its equipment was involved, it denies that negligence, any negligence in maintaining and operating infrastructure.
We did it, but not on purpose.
Right.
Don't blame us.
And, of course, we should also point out that this is a definitive conclusion from the Texas A&M Forest Service that the power poles caused these fires. Now, Washington Post has some exclusive data from a sensor network. There's a company that actually monitors power poles around the country, and this sensor network showed more than 50 faults or places where there's an interruption or some kind of disruption to the power. Mm-hmm. Usually means that a power pole has fallen down or has contacted vegetation or something. So it detected over 50 faults in the 6 hours prior to the fire. So this is something that is surprising to me to have discovered. Texas does not require its utility companies to have a fire prevention plan
of
shutting off power lines in advance of extreme weather.
Of course.
So it's a huge problem, and it's going to be very costly.
It's a huge problem in Texas, in California. It was also related to what happened in Maui, Hawaii last year.
Same things.
So Dale Smith, who operates a large cattle ranch, worked to tally up the number of cattle he lost as the wildfires raged. He said, quote, these fires are becoming a regular occurrence. Lives are being lost. Livestock are being lost. Livelihoods are being lost. It's a sad story that repeats itself again and again.
Yep. Until somebody moves in to change it.
And even if they do, climate change is going to keep making it worse and worse, and these fires larger and larger and more frequent.
Yes.
Thank you very much. On that cheery note, we will get out. Thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. Thanks to those of you kind enough to support our work by hitting a donate button or going to bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site, always known as Twitter, you will find me at The Brad Blog. See you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
So long and thanks.